Welcome into Negative Four, Positive Vibe. CJ Nikowski, Ryan Spielborgs with you. We are now inside of 50 games remaining in the regular season and some big decisions coming down, especially in Chicago. And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say I was surprised because there was a lot building up to this. We know this. The White Sox are a terrible, terrible team, historically bad. It's only going to get worse here down the stretch over these last couple of months because they traded away a couple of pieces. But they make the decision that Pedro Grifol is let go as their manager. And again, I don't know if surprise is the right word to use, Spilly, but it's really hard to put this blame on him. This is a bad team and a bad roster, and it all started when they traded Dylan Cease before the season even started. We knew what was coming in 2024 for the White Sox. I guess you could say maybe not to this level. I don't know what to make of it, but they also let a couple of coaches go as well, some big changes in Chicago. What was your kind of first reaction when we found out that Pedro Grifol was no longer going to be the manager of the White Sox?
I think you and I both agree. Managers don't play baseball games anymore. Last time I checked, Pedro Grifol's ERA was what? You know, what was his batting average this year? So I think there are times where you need a scapegoat in this sport. You can't fire the players. But I also recognize, like, regardless, it felt like it was a toxic environment for Grifol the last, you know, when you're 100 games below 500 in 2 years, that's not good. And whatever you're doing isn't working. So I understand the need for change. It's probably important that the White Sox shake things up because it really is. It's we talk about competitive integrity. There's none right now in Chicago, and I find it really frustrating because, for example, I'm sitting in Minnesota. Minnesota went 12-1 against the White Sox. 12-1. Kansas City Royals have gone 12-1. You have two teams that have a chance for the postseason this year, you know, to get into a wild card spot because they play the Chicago White Sox. You know, so like there's a competitive advantage. Like there's a reason why the American League Central this year where we have these surprise teams. Well, it's because they're playing the frickin' White Sox. You know, like the Yankees aren't playing the White Sox 13 times. The Red Sox aren't playing the Yankees 13 times. So, or the Red Sox aren't playing the White Sox 13 times. So I think when we look at a team as horrible as this, and CJ, there's a legitimate shot that they're going to break the all-time loss record in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. That's not like, I don't care what you say. That's embarrassing. I feel bad for the players. I feel bad for fans. It's not good. It's like, there's no scenario where this is like, oh, this is good for baseball. You don't even get the first overall draft pick anymore for it, CJ. Like you get nothing. You get embarrassed. So I think Pedro Grifol is just the tip of the iceberg of things that need to change. I get it. Chris Getz, as a first-year general manager, this wasn't his manager. So I personally appreciate being able to pick your own people as an executive. That makes a lot of sense because you're gonna succeed and fail with the people that you have around you. I think Grifol ends up with the raw end here, but it also makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it's a bad spot to be put in. For sure. When you know you're taking on a rebuilding team and then you have changes up top really quickly and you're not at the bottom when you take over, right? It's one thing when maybe you're completely emptying out and you're near the bottom and you bring somebody in who can teach the game's got a good reputation. People like, this is your first shot. It was a near impossible situation to be in. And so I feel bad for him from that standpoint. And you hear me say this all the time on our radio show, every time that we talk about these kinds of things, losing brings out the worst in people. It just does. And so for Pedro Grifol to even try to stay steady the best that he could and keep some kind of positive message or at least the right message in that spot had to be an issue for him. But there's been also just for whatever reason, it hasn't just been Pedro Grifol. We can go back a couple of different managers and look at what looked like a pretty good roster on paper. And for some reason, things not working out in Chicago with the White Sox, even when they had a good payroll with good players and the money was spread out pretty well, and they weren't necessarily bogged down by any big contracts, they were still an underperforming team. I don't know what to make of any of that because you're talking about different people in leadership over the course of that. But it just seems to continue to happen. And so if that culture is still struggling, is a little bit toxic, you know, ultimately it's probably key pieces and players, and there's been a ton of turnover there as well. So who knows if they finally have gotten rid of what they needed to get rid of out of the clubhouse. It's just a really tough position for Pedro Grifol to have to be. And you feel bad for guys because these jobs are really difficult to come by. Your first one's always going to be your toughest because no matter how long you've been around the game, there's always little things you got to learn along the way. You're going to hear down the road for Pedro Grifol things he would have done differently at some point and what he's learned from that experience. And hopefully he gets another shot. But this one would be, you know, a tougher one to bounce back from. I will say this. I heard somebody, I don't remember who wrote this or said this, but I kind of like it in the sense that, yeah, this team is going to be historically bad. His name is not really going to be attached to it because he wasn't there start to finish, right? It's not going to be the Pedro Grifol 125 loss season. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he started out as the manager, but for the last 2 months, like when they set this record, if they get there, he's not going to be there, right? So I feel like it's not going to, not that it's not going to follow him, but I don't think it's going to be nearly as bad had he been there wire to wire. Again, I don't think he looks at that as them doing him a favor, but if you're looking for any version of a very dim silver lining in this, I guess the fact that seeing this as it's probably going to get worse, right, with this team as they've even gotten worse from the roster standpoint over these last couple of months post-deadline, that at least I guess you don't have to see that part of it. I know you want to see everything to the very end, but you and I talked about this, like during the losing streak, and hearing like media kind of pile on, like I was like, ugh, like I get why they do it. Even local, even their own like pregame show, I'm like, this is a little much. And it's easy to pile on when things are this bad. I'm like, that was just going to continue and only get worse. So there's got to be a part of them that's like, you know what? It was an awful situation. Yeah, I probably could have done some things a little bit different and a little bit better. But he can wake up today, even though it didn't go his way, of not having to deal with that bull crap right now.
Oh God, I guarantee he woke up and the birds were singing. The birds are singing. His hair, he grew hair overnight. Like I bet you the stress of getting the hell out of there is going to just improve his lifestyle. One thing that stood out when Chris Getz was talking about this yesterday, and I'd love to hear your take on it. Grady Sizemore is going to be the interim manager. And Grady Sizemore was a hell of a player who was sidetracked by injuries. I mean, there's probably not a lot there's even out there in Major League Baseball right now where they have the skill set of Grady Sizemore. Like I can't even think of one off the top of my head where it's a 30 home run bat, Gold Glove center field, 30 stolen bases. I mean, he was basically Jacoby Ellsbury before Jacoby Ellsbury. In the case of Sizemore, he's really quiet. He's kind of reserved, really good baseball mind. I've been around him for when I was with the Guardians or the Indians in 2012. So I like him. I was also shocked that he was in baseball. He was with the Diamondbacks a year ago, and that's a pretty good system to be in. My question to you is not about Grady Sizemore, but Chris Getz said yesterday that they're going to look outside the organization for a manager, nobody within the organization. And one of the things about the White Sox that is really apparent is that they're very insular. There's a reason why they've gotten to this problem is that they hadn't really gone outside of their organization, from Rick Hahn to Kenny Williams, and even hear about Jerry Reinsdorf and the relationship with Tony La Russa. That's why they brought him in. Is it too early to just say, hey, we're going to look outside the box here? Or is that appropriate for a GM to say that now?
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to declare anything. Because if you make a declaration and then something comes along that is going to go against that, then you look silly. In the same way that they said Dylan Cease is going to be our opening day starter in January. I'm like, why? Why are you saying that? What if someone absolutely knocks your socks off and they made the deal and he wasn't the opening day starter? So you can say inside and outside, right? And that's fine. And then you have all your bases covered. But declare nothing. You don't want to close a door that you don't want to close because you painted yourself in a corner with something that you said. Now it's easy to get out of it if things work out and you really like Grady Sizemore and say, you know what? This is the guy we want in our clubhouse. The positive responses that we saw, we actually think he's ready for this, you know, and that's fine. And I don't think anybody will give him a hard time. You just don't want to be saying things that all of a sudden now you can't wiggle. You have no wiggle room because you put yourself again kind of in that corner. To your point, looking at the managers in the big leagues right now, Grady Sizemore does have the highest WAR of any player. Take that for what it's worth when you talk about how good of a player he is and was, and a career that was cut short. So he's just under 28 on the Baseball Reference side of WAR. Craig Counsell was the previous record holder. Take that for what it's worth. He was leading the current managers with his 22.4 WAR. But it's him. It's Mark Kotze. Bud Black, Dave Martinez, and then there's a, you know, a drop off after that. And then of course we have a bunch of managers, I believe it's 11, that actually never played in the big leagues right now. 11 of the 30 have never played in the big leagues. So that's obviously not a prerequisite. There's something about it. Now, as you and I talk about often, is can you have a guy who was a really good player be a good manager? Can you lead men? Can you teach the game? Can you get the most out of them when you were really good? I do think the injuries in a weird way probably help, right? Because of the track that he was on. When you talk about the ability to coach, the guys that cruise through a career that are really good, not that it's easy, but have these great careers, it's a little bit harder for them. It's a little harder to relate to the grind of the everyday guy, the 26th man on your roster, and have patience for that guy. In this case, I think Grady Sizemore probably does understand that, right? The injuries and missing two full seasons in 12 and 13, and then just kind of some of that time afterwards that he spent in Boston and Philly and bouncing around in Tampa over those last 3 years and never quite getting back to where I think we all thought he was going to be. The bulk of what we're talking about, really all of that war on the positive side, happened through his age 28 season. He continued to play until he was 32, but it was an absolute grind for him. So you'd like to think that there's something about that in that lesson. Gives you a little more appreciation for the game, gives you more appreciation for struggles, and we'll see how it plays out. But what a great opportunity for this guy.
I think it's a great opportunity, but he has a couple things, couple tasks that I think are going to be really difficult to shake. First off is the optics of playing for the White Sox. I mean, this is not the first choice for anybody, even in a great city like Chicago. You know, it's been one World Series. Can you blame ownership? Sure, he deserves some of it. There's also kind of like a little bit of a gray area about what's happening with the stadium. Are they going to build a new one? The other thing, and listen, I love, you know, we always say we want somebody to put their name to it, right? Like when you talk trash about something, put your name to it. I'm not going to put any of the players' names that have said the White Sox clubhouse and environment was the worst that they've ever experienced in professional baseball. You probably have talked to some of these guys that have been a White Sox this year. They've said that's the worst experience they've ever had. And that can't change with just a new manager. That's mm-hmm. not just like, hey, like Grady Sizemore's here with a couple of new coaches and all of a sudden it's perfect. So that has to be, that sounds like it's rotting from the inside out. Mm-hmm. So that to me is like, you're just scratching the surface here of the things that would have to change. If you're to come in there, you would have to root and find and dig and really get to what the problems are with what the clubhouse is. And that also means talking to these former players that left, which is mm-hmm. always like a challenge because those opinions are going to be very, very skewed and almost like not believable, but there's truth there. So I like Sizemore, fine, Grifol out, but some major problems have to be addressed.
And I wonder if that's why they also moved on from three of their coaches, right? We saw that Charlie Montoyo and Eddie Rodriguez were let go. One of their assistant hitting coaches was also let go. Like, I don't know how you draw that conclusion, whether you feel like those were Pedro Grifol's allies and just figured these are guys that we want to move on from. It's, you know, interesting decisions there that are made, but you got to have reasons behind it. And so I'll assume that some of that information that they're getting led to those decisions as well. It's a weird kind of spot to be in, but we'll see. We'll see. You know, it's not fair to put a lot of this on Grady Sizemore and see what can he do in just a couple of months with a bad roster, but he is 42 years old. That would make him tied for the third youngest manager in the game. He had a really good career, cut short again, all the things that we talked about. So hopefully for his sake, it ends up being a positive and who knows, maybe landing himself a job. If he doesn't, kind of going back to some of the things that you were saying, this also maybe is not a desirable job, right? That's the other part of it. Like, what do you do? Like, there's so many aspiring managers out there and guys that will do anything to get back in the game. Right. And I'll think about a veteran guy, say like Buck Showalter, or a younger guy like Chris Woodward, who I was with in Texas, loves teaching the game, passionate about the game, positive guy, all that kind of stuff. Maybe a Phil Nevin type. I mean, you got a whole spectrum of guys that I think, of course, would be interested because these jobs are so few and far between. I think Joe Girardi would like to get back in the game on that side of it as well. But how desirable? And I know it's early yet, but I think we have an idea where this roster is headed even for next year. And if they decide not to bring Grady Sizemore back, who wants this job?
I remember in a leadership course I took, You know, there's times where, you know, good executives and people that have led and they talk about, you know, getting your dream job or taking a job or turning a job down because it's not the right time or place. You're either not prepared for it or the environment's not going to be right for you. I think there's going to be some guys where it's not the right environment. It's not the right time and place for like a certain manager. But I think there has to be the right fit. I think there are some guys that this would be the right challenge. They do speak in the right tone and have the right tenor to help push it forward. But there are going to be some guys out of this group that are going to set you backwards or are not going to help you move it forward because they're either not prepared for this. Their you know, bedside manner is going to be not appropriate for this group, right? That so I think if the job search is extensive, there has to be a good fit here. I do think so, but I don't think all of these guys fit for this scenario because it's there's a lot going on.
There is. I mean, everyone wants to be part of the solution, right? And maybe even be the solution. And so you go in with those kind of optimistic views. But I don't know, man. It just seems like they're going to be in this for a while, and how they get out of it will certainly be a challenge. By the way, you mentioned the division. The other four teams in that American League Central, 34-8 against the Chicago White Sox. It's actually the Guardians who have slowed things down. They're five and five. Against the White Sox, but other than that, everyone's been taking it to them. So still some games to be played, not for the Twins and the Royals, who are a combined 24-2 against the White Sox. That is wild, but for the other two teams, they still have some games left with the White Sox. All right, let's move on. Umpiring, always something that comes up only when things just kind of stick out and they're not normal, right? A good umpired game is one that you don't talk about because everything seemed to be in line. We saw a crazy play in Los Angeles, where Miguel Rojas was playing third base. He was way off the bag. There was a bunt. Rojas was at short. Kike Hernandez was playing third, bunt that he fields. And so Miggy's coming over, almost like the wheel play in a way, from shortstop. And the throw, and it was a really nice play. Like, it's a really difficult play, right? You're trying to make that throw to a shortstop on the run, essentially, like trying to get to the bag. Like, the timing of it was all really well executed. Very nice play all the way around. And then we find out, and the runner was out. It was Brandon Marsh by a pretty good margin. It was, again, really good play. But Miguel Rojas gets called for interference. This interference obstruction rule, Spilly, has been wearing me out. Because when they announced in spring training that they were going to start calling this more, and the focus was second and third, I was like, this is going to be a problem. Like, you know, because guys are so used to having a foot in front of the bag. It was a smart idea to bring it up in the sense that you can't have guys where the bag is completely blocked.
Yeah.
And you slide into a guy's foot or his arm, and just because you didn't have a clear path to the bag, that's reasonable. And then I felt like it got quiet. Like, I felt like I didn't hear about this for a while. And a part of me believed, and you and I talked about it on Loud Outs on MLB Network Radio, I'm like, I think they stopped calling this. I think they sent some kind of memo to say back off a little bit. And then out of nowhere, Hunter Wendelstack comes up with a call that we have never seen in our game's history. I'm not sure we'll ever see it again. The explanation was brutal. This was awful, Spilly. This was a really great play. Dave Roberts eventually got ejected. There's no intent to obstruct anything. Brandon Marsh slid right into the bag. This was one of the more frustrating calls, I think, of this season so far.
I think it is the most frustrating call of the season, TJ. And like, I asked Carlos Mendoza, because the Mets were in town, and then I talked to Bud Black. Both guys did not understand the play. They're like, I don't, because it's a baseball move. That's what managers are saying. It's a baseball move. The guys, how is Miguel Rojas supposed to move any different? There was no intent to block the bag. It was to set his feet to catch the ball and throw a tag down. So it's impossible. That's a baseball play. So there's no intent to block the bag. The intent to block the bag is when you're seeing somebody catch and then drop a knee. There was no dropping of a knee. There was no blocking of the bag. And I've even seen one, and you might have seen one of these plays where you have a second baseman. It might be a throw from the outfield. And I think we had one earlier where the second baseman, the infielder, is sliding to try to go grab the ball, and it takes him into the path of the base. You know, and they're having to slide, and they're not sliding to block the bag. They're sliding to get down low enough to make the pick, and they get called for obstruction. It's a stupid call. It was an unnecessary, I think, rule change. There's parts of the rules that we've seen in the last couple of years that I'm a huge fan of. I love the bigger bases. I love the non-shift rule. I'm loving the pitch clock because it makes me get to dinner on time. But this obstruction rule is tired. It's a waste of time. And then the fact that Hunter Wendelstedt is acting like a parking ticket person, just throwing it out there, even though you're like, hey, this, it's like 30 seconds past the 30 minute parking. What are you doing, dude? Let me get out of here. I feel like he went full Paul Blart on us. He went mall cop. And that's what makes it frustrating, because you set a precedent. You set now that this is how we're going to call it. It's like, and I'm not an attorney, but you know, when certain things in the court gets ruled in a certain way, it changes how laws can be interpreted, and you can use it as an opinion based on this is the result here. So, you know, now somebody else is going to have to call that stupid play, and hopefully nobody else does, because they have, you know, some baseball wherewithal.
The explanation from Marvin Hudson on this, when they do this stuff with the pool reporter, made it even more confusing and more frustrating. And this is the quote. He was in front of the bag without the ball, and that's the new obstruction rule. Plus, he was running in front of him to third. He was in front of third without the ball, so he obstructed the runner. The runner did not have a lane to get to the bag. None of that proved to be true, because the runner slid into the bag with zero issue. The other thing is, in almost in that spot, what they're saying is, you don't have the right to go cover the bag there. Because where Miguel Rojas was, he's running to the bag to go cover it. He's not obstructing anybody. Yeah, from shortstop. Right, he's running to third. Also, it's not a new rule. The fact that we have a crew chief saying the new obstruction rule, it's not new. MLB just said, hey, start enforcing this more. Like, that bothers me. I know it might seem like semantics, but acting like it was new. No, this has always been there, but they've asked that you start calling it more, because you haven't been. But this is not what they intended. This is not obstruction when you're running to cover the bag when the throw is getting there. What is the play? Oh, no, you got to be a couple of feet behind him. Or something, you know, it's ridiculous. So I think,
or run around the bag. He would have had to run around the bag. He would have had to run. The shortstop would have had to run into foul territory and then come back around like a question mark.
MLB needs to step in on this one and make a statement on it, because now if you're in that situation, like if a guy is not there, just kind of run into him, get close to him, make it seem like you didn't have a clear path to the bag. So this is what we're not, because again, it's a terrible call. And like you said, a precedent is set. Are guys going to be looking for this? Because you know what's going to really look bad? When it happens again and they don't call it. And then you're going to be like, what is going on here? Can we not get this consistent? That, to me, that was, like you said, kind of like the, you know, 30 seconds over for a parking meter. But, you know, at least with the 30 seconds, technically you have violated the rule. In this situation, you haven't violated anything. Brandon Marsh had a clear path to the bag. He slid into the bag and he touched it. This was almost like someone looking for obstruction, looking for a violation when a violation really wasn't there. And then the reaction, as you said too, like Dave Roberts is not allowed to come out and argue about it. Like, he didn't want to hear about it. No. You're going to listen, because this is a really disputed call and I need to state my case. Eventually he gets thrown out, but to act as if you're above that conversation from Dave Roberts was also bothersome. So I Major League Baseball, again, because we're all going to sit there, we're still sitting in the same spot. You talk to managers about it. Like, I don't think that's right. That seems confusing. So now we are all unclear about this play. Was that really the right call? Again, quote from Marvin Hudson doesn't help. MLB needs to come out and let us know. Yep, that was right. That's exactly how it's supposed to be done. We can all be mad about it because we think it's bullcrap. Or they can say, this was actually a mistake. This was not the intent of the rule, but we could see why. You want to cover for Hunter a little bit? Go ahead. We can see why he called it. So we clarified what's going on, and technically going forward, that would not be an out. Of course, that's going to enrage Dodger fans because they lost that game, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but like for Dodger fans, two things. Did you just hear how we described the play? Kike Hernandez to Miguel Rojas. Your third baseman right now is Kike Hernandez. To your shortstop is Miguel Rojas. The Padres are going to leapfrog you. You better get Mookie Betts and Max Muncy back soon. And then number two, that play didn't lead to the walks that Joe Kelly made. It didn't lead to a bad pitch that led to a homer. So like, I get it. We always have this butterfly effect in baseball. Well, if this pitch, this one pitch, what do we call a strike versus a ball, then the next pitch wouldn't have been a homer. It would have been a two strike count and blah. It doesn't work that way. Like, we like to think it, but that's not the case. So it's a terrible call. It's horse poop. But it still doesn't, take away from the fact that 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 in the Dodgers lineup is not very good right now. And some players have been underperforming. So you can make all the claims that you want right now about like a call not going your way. It doesn't hide the fact that the Dodgers are not as good as the Padres at this moment.
Yep. No, for sure, man. It's really brutal. But we'll see. I guess at this point, if we haven't heard from MLB on it, we're probably not. And so we'll just continue to be confused. We're taping this on a Friday morning. MLB made a pretty big announcement. We'd already heard about it because The Athletic had it first. But the fact that Major League Baseball is continuing with their initiatives around the league, and this will be a fun one. And now that we kind of see how it's going to look, I think it's probably even grabbed a little bit more attention than when The Athletic first reported on it. And that is that we are going to see a game in Bristol, Tennessee next year. The Speedway Classic in 2025 will between the Cincinnati Reds and the Atlanta Braves. It'll be on August 2nd. The venue, I think, actually is going to be pretty cool. I was a little like iffy on it at first. I'm like, I'm not sure what's going on here. What are we doing? And then we start to see some of these renderings, Billy. They're going to put a baseball field, a major league caliber baseball field, in the infield at Bristol. That is going to be pretty cool. That could make for some really cool shots. They're going to put some stands, obviously, behind home plate and other things. But if you haven't seen it, they're all over the internet. This actually should be pretty fun, and it'll be easier on players, right? No going to London for 2 days. No going to Asia and dealing with all the, you know, starting the season early like they're going to do next year in Japan. It's fun. It's cool and all, but, at the end of the day, it's also kind of a pain in the butt for players and wears guys out. And the Dodgers and the Cubs will be doing it again next year. Poor Shohei Ohtani. I mean, I guess that's the price you have to pay for being such an international superstar. But this will be cool. So far, what I've seen on the renderings, I'm kind of more excited about it compared to when I first saw what The Athletic was saying.
Well, and they were smart. I mean, it's the Reds and Braves, and hopefully Ronald Acuna's back. So you have two legit race cars that are going to be in that game. Ellie Dela Cruz has been phenomenal. Have you looked at Ellie Dela Cruz's stats lately? Man, take a peek. Do yourself a favor and take a little peek, because we were discussing last year about how ridiculous Ronald Acuna's season was a season ago with all the extra base hits and the amount of stolen bases. Ellie Dela Cruz is on pace to put up similar numbers, extra base hits and stolen bases. So that's ridiculous. Like, Ellie is awesome to watch. So I could imagine, part of the marketing behind doing this game in Bristol is we get to market Ellie Dela Cruz, the fastest guy in baseball. And like at a racetrack, how cool is that? So I think it's gonna be great. I love these type of concepts. I love the old barnstorming concepts from back in the 1900s when baseball really became America's pastime. It's because baseball was conscious about going to different markets that don't normally get baseball, and that's how they started this grassroots fandom towards baseball. Which is by doing stuff like this. So it's great. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, it should be fun. By the way, you mentioned Ellie Dela Cruz, 59 stolen bases right now through 113 games. He is 59 for 70. So he is well on his way. 20 home runs. So I think realistically, maybe 30 on the high end. I don't think he's not going to get to 40 at this pace, but he does have a shot at 30. What are you going to call it? A 30-80 season?
Yeah.
Yeah. 30-80.
But look at total extra bases, though. How many doubles, triples, and homers does he have combined?
Yeah, he's crushing it. He's got 26 doubles, 20 homers, 7 triples already, and he is also leading the league in punchouts with his 149.
Hey,
that's the tax. That's the tax you got to pay. That is the tax, Billy, for a guy who does it as a switch hitter, too. I mean, that's the other thing that becomes...
Just hit left-handed!
Yeah, but isn't he even better against... I guess not still, nope. Check that. Nope. Against the righties, a 950 OPS. Against the lefties, 672. Shut it down. One way. Go be a star. No more. Yeah, that's kind of crazy to think. But anyway, because he's striking out a bunch anyway. It's not as if you got a switch hitters putting the ball in play a ton. All right. Anyway, good stuff there for sure. That'll be it for us here. A negative war, positive vibes. I mentioned it's Friday. Spilly and I will be on together Monday on Loud Outs on MLB Network Radio, Sirius XM, Channel 89. Make sure you catch us there. You can also catch us on social media at SpillyGoat19. I am at CJ Nikowski. Thanks as always for listening. Have a great day.